It is a certainly it is a big ashkarah to the fact that people are coming out on a cold Sunday night to relearn or perhaps learn things they were not familiar with about the malach of Bishul on Shabbos, and perhaps if this is there's a demand, we'll go on to other malachas as well in the course of the future. But unfortunately, we live in a generation where when somebody pulls out a Hilchos Shabbos sefer, so people dive underneath the table. Shema that they hear a halacha they didn't know about before in the realm of Shabbos, and therefore it is a tremendous zechus to you and for myself as well that we're able to share and to learn more and perhaps refresh our memories in things that we are not familiar about. A quick hakdama, even before we get to halacha, just a quick introduction in machshava just before we begin. Obviously, the main, it goes without saying, but sometimes it needs to be restated, and that is, everybody's ultimate goal is always going to be dveikus with Hashem, being close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and to attain Avas Hashem, to attain the love of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that comes through different areas in life. It comes through Shmir Samitzos, it comes through Tefillah, it comes through Talmud Torah, it comes through the observance of the holidays, it comes through the observance of Shabbos. And therefore, sometimes when it comes to learning the Malachos on Shabbos, or the laws of Shabbos, there is a fear of perhaps I did it wrong, and I'm going to find out something during the shiur I was doing differently before, and I'm going to be a sinner in the hands of an angry God, and that's going to be the end of me and all my children for all future generations. And it's simply not the case. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, as I often like to quote to my students, as the Gemara says, Rachmana libabai, that Hashem only wants our hearts. He wants us to try the best, to do the best that we can, to try a little bit harder than we tried the day before, and to do a little bit more than we did the day before. And therefore, when we come to learn the laws of Shabbos, it's not to be scared or to be overwhelmed or to, find out, that perhaps, I might have been doing things the way I should have been doing them before. It comes with a sense of Avas Hashem and a sense of longing to come closer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that is always our goal in everything we do. In everything we do in the shul, everything we do as a community, everything we do as Jews in our home. The goal is always to come closer to Hashem. And the word halacha is the lashon of holech, to walk with Hashem, and therefore that's what we're doing together for a few minutes this evening. A quick introduction now to the malachas of Shabbos, so we should be aware of what's going on. The Torah says only one malacha explicitly. The Torah says, lo sevar eish b'chol mashloseichem yom haShabbos. One should not have a fire kindled in his house on Shabbos. And together in Parshas Vayakel and Parshas Bekudei, where we have the construction of the Mishkan, and then HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, but when it comes to Shabbos, one should not do this. So we learn that what is the definition of things of Malacha that the Torah says you should not do on Shabbos? The same language of Malacha that we find by the construction of the Mishkan. And therefore we learn that whatever was done in the construction of the Mishkan, in the eyes of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, is considered Malacha on Shabbos as well. The Malbim writes in his Parish on the Torah that the Mishkan is a microcosm of the entire world. It's a small version of the world. Everything that goes on in the Mishkan is a representation of Hashras, Hashchina, the resting of Hashem's presence. And the Mishkan is a representation of Hashem's resting of His presence on the entire world as well. And therefore, through the observance of Shabbos and the refraining of the Malachos on Shabbos, we reflect on Hashem's creativity in the creation of the world. And just like Hashem, so to speak, and that's a longer discussion, it doesn't mean Hashem rested after 6 days of work, so too we rest, and as the Ramban points out, that we rest in order to show that Hashem is the ultimate creator of the world. And therefore, when it comes to defining the word malacha, we will always invoke the definition of Rav Shimshon Rafael Hirsch and his Parish on the Torah and his other writings, because it's become a classic definition, and even though this definition is hinted to in the Gemara and Chazal and the Rishonim and the early Achronim as well, but sometimes it takes a later Achron, sometimes it takes someone we may consider contemporary to kind of say things very clear. And then the definition of malacha does not mean work. The definition of malacha means acts of creativity. We rest on Shabbos because Hashem is the ultimate creator of the world and in our world, and so too we rest on Shabbos to show that we do not perform acts of creativity, and that is why it may be permissible to lift an entire table on Shabbos, midoraisa. However, it might not be permissible to turn on a light, because turning on a light is an act of creativity. raising a table is not creative. It's just burdensome. That's avoda. Avoda means something that is burdensome, that is work. Malacha means acts of creativity. And that's why when it comes to Shabbos, one of the 30 malachos that we have that was done in the Mishkan is a malach of bishul or ofa. The Gemara uses them and interchanges those two expressions, either bishul or ofa, cooking or baking. Where was it done in the Mishkan? Because it was done in order to create the dyes that would be used for the colorings of the clothings of the Kohanim, the dyes that would go on the coverings of the Mishkan, and that's where the malach is found in its creative form in the Mishkan. According to the Rishonim, there is a practical difference between cooking and baking, but that's more theoretical, so we're going to push that to the side for now. The Achronim, so they discuss other forms of using heat to cook food, frying, roasting. They understand it's all part of the Isidoraisa. Anything where you're using a heating element to heat something up is the definition of the Malacha Doraisa of Bishul. This is summarized beautifully by Rav Yehoshua Neuwirth in his classic Shmir Shabbos Kelchasa. Every home should have a Shmir Shabbos, whether in Hebrew or in English. Shmir Shabbos is Kodesh Kadashim when it comes to Shabbos. It's become a useful tool for everybody, and he writes in his first halacha, Echad hamavashal v'echad hatzola, v'hametagin v'ofa, whether you're cooking. Cooking, bishul in halacha generally means b'mtsos hamayim, through the process of water. Boiling, that's really what bishul means. Tzli means roasting, that means using direct heat. Tigun is frying, ofa, baking, whatever it may be. All of these things where you use a heating element to heat something up, that is called machshir davar lachil al yedei chom ha'esh. You prepare food using the heat of the fire, or toldoser, some extension of it. Hareza over al isra bishul. That is the isra d'oraisa of bishul. So what we're going to do this evening and a little bit next time is to discuss the isra d'oraisa of bishul. No derabanans. So we're not going to discuss blech. So we're not going to discuss chomim pots. We're not going to discuss warming drawers. We're going to get there. I know that we are chomping at the bit to get to those things, but we can't appreciate the derabanans of Shabbos unless we first appreciate the d'oraisa. So we will certainly discuss practical things, but we need to build an edifice. We need to build a foundation and a basement and a strong floor before we build on top of those things. So first, let's discuss what's the Torah's definition of bishul when it comes to solid foods. How thoroughly must a food be cooked in order to be chayav midoraisa in bishul? So the Gemara Menachos says that one is chayav for cooking once food has reached the level of machal ben drusai. Ben drusai was the famous bandit, the famous robber who was always on the run from the police, and therefore he would cook his food to a level that was essentially just edible. And therefore we call it cooking to machal, the level of ben drusai. And there's a machlokus amongst the Rishonim what that was. Is it half-cooked or is it third-cooked? And according to the Rambam, it would be a half-cooked, or Rashi says it's a third-cooked. And therefore, even partial cooking of something would be asur midoraisa. If I take a steak and I cook it super rare, you'd eat it if you had to. If you had to and it was, it wasn't perfect, this is all you had to eat, you'd eat it. It's not raw, but you would cook it, pretty red, as they say in French, almost blue. That's how rare it's cooked. So then that would be bishul midoraisa, 100%. Even though perhaps it's not you like well done, that would still be bishul midoraisa. Now how do you measure a third or a half cooked? And this is important. Again, we're not talking about chalent, but it's important to know. For example, you can't put chalent onto the fire before Shabbos if the chalent's not going to be cooked before Shabbos. So if you're sitting a half hour before Shabbos, you didn't put the chalent on, you can't put it on, it's going to cook on Shabbos. So it needs to be at least half cooked. So how do I measure that? How do I know if chalent is half cooked? So the Chazon Ish writes, and this is how we hold the halach, and the Chazon Ish writes in Siman Lamed Zayin, that it's difficult to calculate a half, a third, things like that. So the Chazon Ish says, you look at time. How long does it take the time till it would be mevushal kol tzarcho, totally cooked? So if you usually cook chalent, if you know that I would eat chalent after 6 hours in the on the crock pot, so that means the chalent needs to be cooked for 3 hours before it goes on. We paskin has to be a half cooked, and therefore the chalent needs to be cooked for 3 hours before it goes on before Shabbos. You can't put it on in less time, because then there's going to be continuous bishul as it reaches the point of machal ben drusai on Shabbos. Okay, so you need to make sure that you know it's going to be half-cooked before you put it on before Shabbos. That's the Torah definition of cooking. You violate the Isser Bishul Midoraisa once the food has reached that stage. Now, we're not going to get into this so in depth because it's not so practical for us. It's still usser to put a steak on the fire, even for 3 seconds. Even though it's not going to reach that cooked, I'm just going to put it on for a second and pull it off. It's still usser to put it there. Shema, perhaps you're going to leave it and forget about it. But when in Shemayim does the clicker go, Bishul, right there, it's when it reaches its half-cooked stage. That's Bishul and Salv Midoraisa. Let's talk about liquids, okay? Yeah.
Just a quick review for a second. So if, let's say, Shabbos is at 4:18, then your children has to be up by 1:18, let's say.
Again, theoretically, yes. You'd have to know, yeah.
I respectfully disagree with that because it takes a long time for the water to get hot.
Yeah.
So the Bishul really doesn't start until maybe almost an hour later. So you really have to put it up before because the water...
Correct. So the Chazon Ish, it's not clear the Chazon Ish is talking in halachic times or is he talking in Metzias, the reality of what's going on chemically within the food. The Chazon Ish says you take the time that you set it up and the time you turn it off and you cut it in half. That's the definition the Chazon Ish is giving. So it's true that perhaps if we brought in a chemist, the chemist would say, you know, really it's an hour, then another 3 hours. But in the eyes of the Chazon Ish, you take the entire cooking process from the beginning, whatever you start that as, and then you probably would look at it over there. That's how the Chazon Ish would look at it. But it is a fair, that is a fair point. Let's move on now to liquids. The Gemara in Shabbos Daf Mem indicates that the metric for liquids is not the extent of cooking, but rather the temperature, the magnitude of the heat. And there, if the liquid becomes, as the Gemara says, yad soledes bo, the extent that you would remove your hand from such a temperature of a liquid, if you did not know it was that temperature. And this is important. Now, at the end of the day, I'm going to give you a number. So all this theoretics are going to fall away in a moment. But if it has to be you didn't know. For example, you can touch something that's hotter if you know that it's hot, right? I can stick my hands into the shower if I know it's going to be hot water. Even if I didn't, if I expected to be cooler, so that my hand will jump back much sooner. That's why you may be surprised about how low the numbers go. Because it needs to be a level that your hand would retract if you didn't know it was hot. That's what yad soledes bo means. So, if the water will never reach that temperature, then it's mutter. Again, we're not going down this path right now, but if we're talking about if I wanted to warm food, you can take anything out of the fridge on Shabbos, and you can put it on a heating element that will never reach yad soledes bo. If you just want the kugel to be, you know, lukewarm, and you don't want it to be hot, so find a heating amount that's, you know, 100 degrees and put it there all day long. If it's never going to reach yad soledes bo, which 100 degrees is below according to everybody, then by all means. It's only an issue of Bishul when it comes to yad soledes bo, which reaches that temperature. So there's a machlokas how to calculate. I'm going to tell you right now that in America, the kashrus organizations follow the temperature of 120 degrees. And that's the temperature that is often quoted. Rosh Hashanah uses this. And most of the posts in America say that 120 degrees is the temperature of yad soledes bo. And that is what is generally practiced. There's an Rosh Shlomo Zalman Arbach in Shmir Shabbos Hilchasa has a very creative way of getting to it. The Gemara in Chulin talks about it wants to know if you sheft an animal and you find that the animal is treif, so then maybe the heat of the neck is enough to make the knife treif. So it means there's heat in the process of shechting the animal. When you shech the animal, the temperature goes up, and there's a blast of heat, so to speak, that might make the knife treif if the animal was treif after I shechted it. So they did an experiment, and they shechted a bunch of animals, and they found that the highest temperature you would find on an animal's neck is 113 degrees for a goose. When you shecht a goose's neck, it's 113 degrees. So Shlomo Zalman wanted to say 113 degrees is yad soledes bo. But there's what to say about that experiment. So we go with 120 degrees. If the temperature is below 120 degrees, it's not Bishul on Shabbos. Okay? So let's discuss heat sources right now. So the Gemara in Shabbos distinguishes between three heat sources. There is fire, or any byproducts of fire. That's asur midoraisa, like we said in the beginning. There's the sun. You're allowed to cook directly in the sun. That's mutar l'chatchila. You could take a hamburger, stick it out in the July sun, and cook it in the back. It's perfectly fine. 100% mutter to do such a thing. don't know if I would eat it, but it's 100% mussar to cook in that way. Using chama, using the sun, is 100% fine. Now, then there's something called toldos hachama, byproducts of solar heat. So, for example, you can only cook that hamburger if you leave it on something that is directly, that is not also going to be cooking from underneath. If I take a cast iron pan and I put the hamburger out in the July sun, and now it's being cooked not just through the sun, but through the residual heat coming off the pan, that's asumi d'rabbanan. You'd have to take the hamburger and put it on something that would not be heated up, and only then would be permissible. So the three levels. The sun, 100% mutter, heat and the byproducts of direct heat is asumi d'raisa, and heated by the sun is asumi d'rabbanan. What we're not talking about are things like using water heated up in a dud shemesh, which we don't have in America, so we're not going to discuss it right now. In Israel, this is more of a shaila. Can you use water heated up in a dud shemesh? But we're not going to go into it because nobody really has that in America. So why is one allowed to cook in the sun? This is important, even though we don't cook in the sun for other reasons. So Rashi says that cooking in the sun is eino derech bishul. It's not normal to cook that way. So there's a machlokus. What does Rashi mean? It's not normal to cook that way. So comes the Igle Tal, and he says that it creates a shinoi in the quality of the food. Cooking in the sun doesn't cook to the same way as cooking on a grill. It's a shinoi in halacha, if it's not the way that the malacha is usually done, so it's mutter, and therefore that's what Igle Tal says by sun. Rav Moshe writes in Orach Chaim, he says that it's not bishul, because it's not derech bishul that it was used in the Mishkan. In the Mishkan, they never cooked in the sun. In the Mishkan, they used heat, fire sources, and the derivatives of fire, and therefore that's what the issue is. And therefore, if you're not using in the way that was done in the Mishkan, says Rav Moshe, that would be 100% fine. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach says that only cooking over a flame is asur min haTorah, anything else is not bishul min haTorah. So this touches upon the question of using a microwave. Now, we don't use a microwave on Shabbos for other reasons, but theoretically, what would be the problem with using a microwave on Shabbos? Is a microwave used direct heat? I don't want to bring back nightmares of high school chemistry, but does a microwave use direct heat? No. Microwaves heat up the liquid that is inside any product, and it causes them to vibrate, and it causes those liquids to heat up. Meaning there's no, if you put your... Theoretically, the microwave should not be hot after it's done being used. Any heat is coming off of the food. There's no heat source going around the microwave. The microwaves interact with the liquids and it causes them to heat up. The famous story, how they invent the microwave, the guy was working on the Air Force and he had a chocolate bar in his pocket, and it melted after he was working on some machine that had used microwaves. He wondered why it was melting, because it was cold in the room, and he realized that the microwaves were interfering with the chocolate bar and it was causing it to melt even though there was no heat. So the same thing over here. It's not. I haven't used any direct heat. So maybe theoretically, if I could get a microwave that didn't use electricity, I could cook with it on Shabbos. So Rav Moshe, according to Rav Moshe, it would be usser. Why? Why would it be usser? Because Rav Moshe says anytime something becomes derech bishul, anytime in society becomes a normal way to cook, it becomes usser midoraisa. That's how we learn some Rashi. And therefore, in our American society, it is normal. I'm not talking about what you think about the quality and whether it's this fine French cooking. It's normal to cook in a microwave. People heat up things in the microwave all the time. And therefore, Moshe was holding it's asur midoraisa. The other opinions may hold it would be asur midorabanan.
Isn't it different warming up versus cooking
them? In a microwave?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you don't really cook in a microwave.
You can.
It's a derech bishul. People put in popcorn. They make popcorn in the microwave.
You don't generally do it, and you only use it for warming up.
We're not talking about an individual. We're talking about society. In American society, there's a whole freezer section in the supermarket made for people who cook in the microwave, and therefore it becomes derech bishul.
It's not pre-cooked.
What?
That stuff's not like kind of pre-cooked.
Usually, it's baked potato. You want to cook it in the oven?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, that's for sure. Okay, good. Let's turn now to the issue of Kli Rishon, Kli Sheni, Kli Shlishi. A Kli Rishon is a container of the food that has been heated up to Yad to lettuce bow, and it is on the fire. Okay? That's the definition of a Kli Rishon. The Rishonim and the Shulchan Aruch and Siman Shin Yud Ches 318 is the main Siman Shulchan Aruch for the laws of Bishul. They are clear that a Kli Rishon maintains its status even if it is not in the fire anymore, but it is still Yad Salem. So I have a pot of hot soup that has been heated up Friday night, and I take the soup off the fire, and it is still very hot. It is 100% still a Kli Rishon for all intents and purposes. The halacha for a Kli Rishon is that nothing uncooked can be put into a Kli Rishon at all. This includes putting spices as well that have not been pre-cooked. Now you have to know your spice cabinets. You have to know what has been pre-cooked and what has not been pre-cooked. And it was fair to assume that there are things in there that may have been roasted, but not pre-cooked. There's a difference between roasting and bishel. When we get to the topic of ein bishel achar bishel, re-cooking things, you're not allowed to re-cook things that were baked or roasted. If it was done in a different method of cooking, then you can't say ein bishel achar bishel. So here, you have to be careful if you think that the soup on the fire is, or soup off the fire, which is a Kli Rishon, is not spicy enough, and you want to throw in whatever into there. Now, maybe salt is what's discussed, because generally salt in America, as we'll see, is perhaps cooked beforehand. But you can't simply go and throw extra spices into the Kli Rishon for your family, because you are cooking in the Kli Rishon. Okay?
Did you go over that bishul achar bishul?
I want to save it for another time.
No, because you mentioned it.
Yeah, so it's true. You did catch me. So I did mention it. Bekitzer. The Torah, it's not prohibited to cook something that was already cooked. Right? Once its status has been changed and the heat has changed the food itself, it's not prohibited to cook it again. You can't cook it more than once. However, that only applies to the same method of cooking that you did beforehand. This is the issue by challah. Challah is baked. And I want to take challah and I want to dip it into hot soup. I'm not saying yes or no yet. But we have an issue here, perhaps, of cooking. Because the challah was baked. And that's one form of cooking. And the soup, through emsas hamayim, through the path of water, is a different method of cooking. And therefore, there's what to discuss. It's mutter at the end of the day.
Same with croutons
at the end of the day as well.
But
now,
not all croutons,
those yellow mandel, so it used to be that they were fried or whatever it is. In Eretz Yisrael, the packages would come and say that it's mutter because they were fried and they had like a stamp from Rav Vazner on it that you could use in your soup on Shabbos. But anyway, again, without really going too much, where the soup bowl at the end of the day is probably already a Kli Shlishi. And we're going to have other leniencies over there as well. So that's going to be why it's okay. So let's get to a Kli Shlishi. Excellent segue. So there are a number of items that have already been cooked that can be put into a Kli Rishon on Shabbos. Instant cocoa is already cooked. You want to put instant cocoa into your hot pot on Shabbos? And that's what you're into? Then by all means, because the instant cocoa has already been cooked in the factory, and it's sent to you. Bottled lemon juice.
What about, like, aren't you changing the color? Is that an issue?
It's no ain tzveya ba'ochlin. There's no tzveya by food. There's no tzveya by food. There's a chumra by liquids. But even there, there's what to discuss.
Because for coffee, I usually...
Yeah, totally.
You put the water onto
the...
Actually,
the over the coffee, so it doesn't change the color.
So
let's talk
more about lunch.
We're going to talk more about making tea and coffee in a second. Instant coffee, instant tea, instant soup. Not tradition soups. Not like anybody has tradition soups anymore, but those tradition soups that kids used to have in camp and things like that. Oh, you do? So those are other issues, because there are issues with tradition soups. We'll get to later on, because they're Kali Habishal. Rav Moshe says even someone who is Machmer should allow Iri Kli Rishon. Meaning, you can, in all these things we just mentioned, the instant cocoa, bottled lemon juice, sugar, instant coffee, instant tea, instant soup without anything else in it, we will allow Irui Kli Rishon 100%. Irui Kli Rishon means pouring from a Kli Rishon onto a food. So theoretically... So theoretically, you could take a pack of instant cocoa and directly from the hot water or from the pump, put it directly onto it, because it's Iri Kli Rishon, and the cocoa, instant hot chocolate, has already been cooked. So there's no issue whatsoever. The only exception would be Turkish coffee. Has anybody here drink Turkish coffee? Turkish coffee is made in a way where the coffee, where the grounds are roasted, they're not cooked, and therefore it might be different. But unless you're drinking Turkish coffee, we're going to move on.
So you can have cocoa on Shabbos?
Yeah, for sure. Have a great time.
You don't have to make it into a cliche, maybe?
No, it's already in the shalach
HaMishnah. You can't put it directly. If you put hot cocoa in a cup, you can't pour it from the cleavage on top of the hot.
You can.
You can.
But it's already cooked. The instant cocoa is already cooked.
And coffee too.
Well, instant coffee is already cooked as well, yeah. Okay, now. Now, the salt that gets on your table is unclear. Salt, it's hard to tell the salt that you buy how it's being made, whether it's using different processes, and therefore when it comes to salt, it should not be placed in a kli rishon. We shouldn't put salt in the kli rishon because there's an unclear, salts are made through different methods and they're processed in different ways, and it's hard to know, so you shouldn't put salt in the kli rishon. Let's move on to kli sheni. The Gemara says that when you pour the contents of a kli rishon into a kli sheni, into another container, that's a kli sheni. And the Gemara in Shabbos says, kli sheni eino mevashel. The kli sheni, nothing cooks in the kli sheni. So what's the difference between a kli sheni if they're both yatzel lettuce bow? Again, once the food is no longer yatzel lettuce bow, and it's below 120 degrees, do whatever you want with it. But if the kli rishon is yatzel lettuce bow, and the kli sheni is yatzel lettuce bow, so who cares? It's the same thing. They're both cooking. So there's a Tosos explains, defunos mekaros, that when the food is now put into another kli, the walls of the new kli begin to drop the temperature more rapidly than the walls before that were heated up by the fire. And there's a discussion, well, why is that correct? So the Chazon Ish and the Rashba say, it's a physical reality. A kli sheni physically cannot cook. It's not capable of cooking. The Or Samach explains that, no, this is not a physical statement. This is not a scientific statement. It's a halachic reality. The Torah is telling you that a kli sheni is not cooking in the eyes of the Torah. That's what it is. Yes, if I brought in a scientist, they would tell you that, you know, there's change going on. But through halachic eyes, we look at that same thing. In the kli sheni, there's no cooking going on. This is the approach of the Or Samach. Now, at the end of the day, the rule is the rule. The halacha is the halacha. Kli sheni eino mevashel. Now, what does that practically mean? That a kli sheni doesn't cook. So we find in a number of places in Shas that do seem to say there were certain things that could not be placed in the kli sheni. And this creates a big issue. Because on one hand, we have the rule, a kli sheni, a receptacle of a kli rishon, it's not possible to cook in it, and it's 100% fine to use. No cooking goes on. But the other times, we have the Gemara telling us they didn't put things in the kli sheni. So the theme seems to be in all those cases is kale habishal, things that cook easier in a low temperature. However, there's a question how to define what can and cannot be placed in the kli sheni as a machlokas rishonim. The Ran says that because we don't know what can and cannot be put in a kli sheni, we must assume that everything can be put in a kli sheni. The Ran says, well, I can't figure out what is and what's not a kli sheni, so everything must be mutter then. Right? I can't walk around my whole life assuming everything is kali habishal. I can't tell me if I take a thick steak and drop it in something that's a kli sheni, you're going to tell me it's kali habishal? Like, I can't cook in it? So the Ran says, assume you can put anything in unless told otherwise. And the Urayim goes the other way. The Urayim says that this is a suffix, and because of the suffix, you can't put anything in a kli sheni. Mikatza lakatza, two extremes. I don't know what a kli sheni is, therefore everything is mutter. I don't know what a kli sheni is, therefore everything is usser. So what do we do? There's no compromise over here. So in this case, the Shulchan Aruch finds a leniency based on this machlokes, and he says that there's one area you can be makel. And he says that in a case of bishul acharafia, like we said before, if I'm cooking something that was previously baked, we're leaning to the kli sheni, and because of this, there's, without question, even Svardim can put soup in bread and soup that's not a lettuce bow. Because we'll be makel in a kli sheni. Yeah.
Is a ladle considered a kli sheni?
So that is also, we're going to discuss ladles another time. That is a machlokes. But this is another leading would be that perhaps a ladle is a kli sheni. The why you would say it's not a kli sheni is because it's only there for a moment. But let's hold off on ladles for another time. Well, so based on these principles, there's no problem putting your challah in the soup, even if the soup is yatzal lettuce, because we'll be lenient for a klisheni by bishul achar afiyah. However, there comes the Rama, who, as Rav Yosef likes to say, Ashkenazim yotzim biyad Rama, the Ashkenazim go out with the hand of the Rama, and therefore this is who we follow in most cases, that the halacha follows the Urayim, and therefore we shouldn't put potentially usher items into a klisheni, even like bread. And the Mishavura goes further and says, we should be stringent about a klisheni even for all foods. And therefore, as a policy on Shabbos, we do not put things even in a klisheni. The Shulchan Aruch seems to believe a klisheni doesn't cook, and one need not be concerned that everything might fall into the category of Kali Abishol. But if we observe that certain food is Kali Abishol, then one should be machmor for this reason. The Aruch HaShulchan says not to put tea leaves into a klisheni, because tea leaves are very light, they're very thin, and we seem to say that you can certainly brew the tea in a klisheni, and therefore not to put tea leaves in a klisheni. We'll get to tea. We're going to get to tea in general in a second. We'll get to tea. We'll just spend most of the end piece on tea. Yeah.
So is there a difference between tea leaves and coffee?
We're going to discuss in a moment. So instant coffee would be fine, huh? Because it's ein bishul achar bishul. The Shmirah Shabbos says the minhag of Ashkenazim is to follow the Mishabura and not to put anything in a klisheni, because we're concerned that everything may be kali abishul. There were certain foods that the Gemara explicitly allowed to put in a klisheni that are not kali abishul: oil, I don't know why that's going to come up, water, and spices. You can put water into a klisheni. You want to cool down a klisheni. Right, your some of the kids say that, you know, the soup is too hot, you know, so put an ice cube in it, put water in it. So that would be fine, because it's there's no bishul over here as well. Spices also, your soup is let's assume for a second a bowl of soup is a klisheni. Your soup is not whatever enough for you. It needs more salt, oregano, I don't know, whatever you want to put in. So you can put it in a klisheni without question at all. Now, there is a machlokas between the Aruch HaShulchan and the Mishnah Berurah as to whether onions are considered spices. Are they spices, or are they something else? The Igros Moshe says onions are not spices. We should be machmer not for onions in the klisheni. I don't know what that case is, why you want to put onions in the klisheni, but we should be machmer for onions in such a case. What's the status of ground spices sold in stores nowadays? So Rosh Shlomo Zalman Auerbach says, our spices are extremely fine, and therefore they are going to be cooked in Kali Abishol. Says Rosh Shlomo Zalman, no spices in the klisheni. Rav Moshe, who we follow, writes that cocoa, coffee are included in the category of spices. It's permissible to put them in a klisheni, even if they weren't cooked, and even if they're finely ground, and therefore it appears that all ground spices, according to Rav Moshe, can be put in a klisheni, and that's how we would paskin lahalacha as well. Let's move on now to a kli shlishi. Kli shlishi is not mentioned in the Gemara. It's not even mentioned in Shulchan Aruch, a kli shlishi. The earliest mention of a kli shlishi is the Prima Gadim, Rav Yosef Teumim, who lived in the 18th century. So he says that everyone should agree that nothing can be cooked in a kli shlishi. If you're, you know, hacking me a chinik about the klisheni, so at least in a klishlishi we should agree. A pot that receives the contents of a klisheni, and this is cited by the Mishnah Berurah and Rav Moshe Feinstein, the Chaznish argues on that logic. He says, you can't just invent a klishlishi, Prima Gadim. Like, you know, I have great respect for you, but like, you can't just invent something that wasn't discussed for the last 2,000 years. Like, what do you get that you can't just invent the concept of a klishlishi? But he concludes, the minhag is to be lenient anyway by klishlishi. However, if something is known to be Kali Abishol, then it shouldn't be placed in a Kli Shlishi as well. So, based on the above, and the Chaznish, many of the minhag to only place a teabag in a Kli Shlishi. And that's where the minhag comes from, that you will take the contents of the urn and put it into a cup, and you'll put that into another cup, and that's a Kli Shlishi, and the Prima Gadim, and Rav Moshe, and the Chaznish will all give you a big bracha, you did the right thing, everything is wonderful, and everybody would allow a Kli Shlishi in such a case, according to them. When it comes to making tea, there is a very, very long sif katan in the Mishnah Berurah. The Chafetz Chaim not only tells you about the issues of making tea, he gives you a whole recipe. It's a one-stop shop. He talks about tea, how to make tea, and the Chafetz Chaim tells us about tea essence. The Chafetz Chaim is very machmer kali bishul. The Chafetz Chaim said Now the tea leaves are kali abishal, even a kli shlishi, a kli revi, a kli chamishi, a kli shlishi. I don't care. If it's yatsa lettuce bow, it's going to cook those leaves, says the Chavetz Chaim. So the Chavetz Chaim told us, one, we have to make what on Shabbos?
Yes.
Tea essence. So you take essence, you boil a lot of bags before Shabbos, you have a thick brew of tea, and you dilute it later on. Why does that work? Because we said that you can put water in a kli sheni, right? So since you can put water in a kli sheni, says the Chavetz Chaim, therefore if I'm just adding water to hot water, that would be perfectly fine. And therefore there are those who are machmer for the mishabur over there to make tea essence for Shabbos. I feel that the minhag in America is not that way. I feel like most people do not
make
tea.
It used to be.
I feel it is not. It has come out of style. I feel like most people do not make tea essence anymore. If that's what you've been doing, then keep on doing it. You shouldn't change. Yeah.
Someone has and they make tea for you.
Yeah.
And they use klishlishi.
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting.
Who normally would not make tea like that?
Yeah.
Like
and they made it for you?
Yeah. They hold that it's okay.
If sure, it's a chashash of bishul do raisa, according to you, and therefore perhaps I would be concerned about it.
Well, we tell them, like, oh, sorry, I don't drink your tea
in Shabbos. What? I would come prepared. I would come if I was machmer for the Chavetz Chaim. Again, you have to know why you're machmer. This is a general discussion across the board. If a person has a chumrah and the other person doesn't have a chumrah, so I can rely on the other person's kula in my case, right? So you do open bala kaps on Shabbos. Yeah, I don't open bala kaps on Shabbos. So can you rely on it? If you think that someone who makes tea leaves on Shabbos is a step away from, you know, one foot in Gehenna, and like, you know, you know, and that's, you know, he, you, and, you know, you, I wish him good luck, but I don't want to eat the same Shabbos table with him. So then I would say you should probably not rely on this tea because you think that that's a chashash of bishul d'oraisa. Cooking the cliche, according to the Chavetz Chaim, is an issur d'oraisa. There's an issur of maisa Shabbos. The issues of bishul on Shabbos and where I can benefit from somebody's prohibitive cooking on Shabbos apply by an issur d'oraisa. That's why I generally say, if you're in somebody's house and they mess up by the blech or something like that, you could probably still eat the food anyway because there's no prohibition of getting benefit from issuri d'rabbanan by Shabbos. But by an issur d'oraisa, here, the whole shir, the last 37 minutes is Yisroi D'Oraisa. It's a serious thing, so therefore I would be concerned, perhaps, if a person feels that this is very, if a person, however, is, as a chumrah, you know, I make her adin, I think that tea bags are fine. But my Zaidi, you know, they all made tea sense, so then this is what I'm going to do. So then perhaps I would be lenient in that case. But if you feel admonished that this is a big problem, then I would not rely on somebody else's tea in such a case. I'll give you the most Mekel Shita. There is a tradition in the Soloveitchik family. Going back to Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, that Reb Chaim Soloveitchik said, don't tell me that everything is Kali Abishal. If I don't know what it is, it must be fine. Like we quoted before from the Ran. So Rabbi Soloveitchik of Rosh Yeshiva of YU and from his family would all make tea in a kli sheni, lichat chila, without question. They would take a cup and they would pour the water into it and it would be 100% fine. No questions asked at all, 100% fine. Rabbi Soloveitchik was a very, very religious man. And he had kept all of the chumras. And in the Soloveitchik family, this was the Masorah, that tea leaves are not Kali Abishal, and you can put them in a klisheni without question. Therefore, many, many fine homes of people who will, from the urn, into the teacup, and put the tea bag into that teacup and enjoy a delicious cup of tea without any issue at all. You should continue to do what you've been doing. Whatever you've been doing in the past, unless, of course, you've been like heating up a pot of tea on Shabbos, but whatever you've been doing in the past, you should continue to do it, and that would be fine.
But when you make tea and you pour it into a cup,
yeah,
all right, and then you pour it into kosher shlishi. What yeah. about that cup that had the water?
Yeah,
you know, you poured it out, but there's yeah. a few drops left there.
Yeah,
you can't use that same cup to make them because you're heating.
You're heating up the droplets of water. So that is
an each time you have to use a new cup.
Usually, it would be preferable to dry out the cup between each time to not heat up those, unless the droplets are still hot. If the droplets are still warm, then that would be fine. But if they've cooled down, then you would have a problem.
But there's no problem with heating up water.
What?
Didn't you just say before there's no problem with heating up water?
In a cliché.
Right. So that's what she's saying. It's a cliché.
But now, when I pour the water from the urn onto it, that's going to be coming from it. That's iruy kli rishon. That's pouring from a kli rishon, which is more severe than a kli sheni. Meaning this is the urn, yeah. Right? This is the urn, and this is the pot that I just. This is the cup I just used, and there's droplets in the bottom. So when I empty into the urn, I have hot water from a kli rishon pouring directly onto the droplets in the cup. That's not a kli sheni. That's iruy kli rishon. That's pouring directly from a kli rishon. That's more severe. If the droplets inside have now cooled to room temperature, below yatzal lettuce bow, so then the water is going to be cooking them. If the droplets are still hot, then it's ein bishlach acher bishl. Does that make sense? Ish?
I was thinking.
Okay. So, fine.
What if those drops are in a kli shlishi?
What if those drops are in a kli shlishi? Doesn't make a difference.
You still have to wipe it out?
It wouldn't make a difference. It would be a problem as well. The same thing, the person wants to refill the tea in their cup, it's important to wipe out the droplets of the cup. To make sure it's not being cooked again. If you're pouring directly from the kli rishon, okay.
If someone did use two,
I'm gonna pause now, but we'll continue to ask questions if you want.